Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppins.
My name is Catalina McGowan.
And as we are on the road, we are actually taping this, and we are actually the evening of Good Friday, and we are in the lovely town of Oviedo, which is in Spain. And the reason why we find ourselves here on Good Friday is very interesting and very important, because for people who remember some of our previous shows about a year ago, or who might have read my article in Atlantis Rising, Oviedo is known for something very specific, the Shroud. Now, immediate reaction might be, well, isn't the Shroud in Turin? What happened to the Shroud? Why did it end up in Oviedo? And the mystery here is that there is not just one Shroud, but actually two. And to give a very long conversation into in a nutshell, here's how it worked. The story is that when Christ is hanging at a cross, he dies and his family is allowed to come and take the body. And when they do so, they wrap what we would call a towel, a cloth around his head, because it is bloody and it is a Jewish custom that clearly a person who's undergoing rigor mortis shouldn't be shown as such to his immediate family. And so they wrap a cloth around the head, take the body down from the cross and prepare it for burial. And at burial, they remove this single cloth and then basically wrap the body in a longer cloth, which covers the entire body. And then at Easter, what happens when Mary Magdalene enters the tomb? She finds that the body is missing. And she sees certain things which suggest that the body hasn't been moved by its own accord, hasn't been moved by any person, but has disappeared. Something miraculous has happened. And some of the evidence that a miracle truly has happened is still visible. Fast forward a millennium years, and really where you end up is in Oviedo, where it is found that the cloth which is wrapped around Jesus' head is located in a casket, which a few centuries before came from Jerusalem, maybe through Alexandria, to Spain. Fast forward 400 years in time, when in France we see a new discovery being made. Somebody has found the cloth which is said to be the one in which Jesus was buried. And several years later, this goes on a public display in Chambéry. Fast forward even more, around 1900, and we see that somebody makes a photograph. And through this photograph, begins to see certain details which the naked eye hasn't really discerned so far. And we see an outline of a man lying in death. Clearly, the story of Jesus is backed up. But then comes 1988 and the story of the carbon dating of the Turin Shroud, which suggests it's a medieval fake, like maybe so many other medieval fakes. But then even more recently, after all of that, it's back to Oviedo, where a small group of people are beginning to look into what they have and begin to realize and start making use of computer analysis and all of that technical stuff. Scientists are called in, and what they find is probably the most stunning discovery.
I want to go back and say that last year, last spring, I believe it was May, you'll find it in our archives, we did a show on the Turin Shroud because we were in Turin and we were looking at the Shroud and we had been studying the Shroud in great detail. So I don't want to go too much into the history of the Turin Shroud because we have done that and because I really want to focus on Oviedo. But what's important is that these two shrouds work together to create an extraordinary body of evidence for Christ's crucifixion and potentially his resurrection. And where in the Turin Shroud is very much about the resurrection, the Oviedo Shroud is very much about the crucifixion. But they do prove each other out. And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about. But I just wanted to mention through all of this Shroud lore and all of this historical back and forth, is the Shroud a fake? Is the Shroud authentic? The carbon dating in the 80s that says it is, in fact, from the Middle Ages. We did a very thorough show on how that carbon dating has proven to be inaccurate at best, dishonest, and a type of conspiracy at worst. But it's now very, very clear that the carbon dating that was done on the Shroud of Turin really cannot be taken seriously. And in fact, the most recent information on the Shroud really, I believe, completely plays out that it is authentic to the first century. But again, we've done a show on that, so if you want to listen to our show on the Shroud, please go take a look in the archives, see if you can download that and listen to it on iTunes. Go to thespiritrevolution.com. As always, you can see all of our shows from the past. But today we're talking about the other Shroud. In fact, here's the interesting thing. There were once, according to history, three Shrouds. There were multiple burial cloths. There was a burial cloth that is described in various places in history and folklore that is similar to the Shroud of Turin. Same size, same length, same fabric, but unlike the Shroud of Turin, which actually has an image on it, the other shroud did not have an image. It was strictly covered in bloodstains. That shroud was accounted for historically and through oral tradition until the French Revolution. And it is believed that the revolutionaries, while they were destroying so many of the important Christian relics that, and also destroying so much of the important Christian art, they destroyed this shroud as well. So one of the many, many great tragedies of the French Revolution, not only the human toll that was taken in that terrible, terrible bloody time, but the toll on us culturally and spiritually and archaeologically was also quite terrible. But across the border in Spain, we are in Oviedo. Oviedo is in the northernmost part of Spain, a place called Asturias, close to the coast, very beautiful part of the world. Since about the early 600s, there has been a record of this extraordinary cloth called the sudarium. Now, one of the things that's interesting to note here is a sudarium represents something that is a different size than a shroud. The Shroud of Turin, which is also sometimes referred to as the Sindon or Sindonology, the shroud refers to a full body covering. A sudarium refers to something that strictly wraps around the head. And we know now from research that it was traditional to cover the head of a crucifixion victim before you took his body from the cross. And before we go any further, I really want to credit the extraordinary work of a wonderful researcher named Janice Bennett. It was Janice Bennett who sent both Philip and I on this path with her extraordinary book that came out about 10 years ago. Janice's book is called Sacred Blood, Sacred Image, The Sudarium of Oviedo, New Evidence for the Authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. And she does the most extraordinary job in English that has ever been done in terms of really giving you the history, the background, and the authenticity of this particular relic. So I definitely recommend, if you are interested in this subject, to grab Janice's book because it is unputdownable. But one of the really interesting things about the Sudarium of Oviedo is it's mentioned in the Gospel of John. Now, I've always had a little bit of a problem with the Gospel of John because it is the Gospel that actually diminishes Mary Magdalene's importance. So for a personal reason, John and I don't always get along. But John chapter 20 is extremely important for those of us who are looking at shroud lore because this is what he says. So Peter and the other disciple went out and came to the tomb. They both ran, but the other disciple ran faster than Peter and arrived at the tomb first. He bent down and saw the burial cloths there, but he did not go in. When Simon Peter arrived after him, he went into the tomb and saw the burial cloths there, and the cloth that had covered his head, not with the burial cloths, but rolled up in a separate place. Then the other disciple also went in, the one who had arrived at the tomb first, and he saw and he believed. So this is the place where we see in the Gospels a reference to the cloth that had covered his head. And this is the cloth that is on display in Oviedo. But I suppose on display is not necessarily accurate, is it, Philip?
It's sometimes on display.
Rarely on display.
And rarely comes in the shape of three times, and today, Good Friday is one of them. And obviously, the reason why a cloth used in getting Christ from the cross, the day to display these kind of things is Good Friday, because that is the day when this happened. The memory of that day is specifically so strong today. So what happens in Oviedo is that for up until a very long time, the cloth was never shown. In fact, early on in 600, 700, 800 AD, it is now widely assumed that the sudarium was already in Oviedo. And then a bishop opens a treasure casket and starts making an index and realizes what is inside. And there's quite a few things in there, including the sudarium. And then about 200 years later, it is Alfonso II, the king of Asturias, not to be confused with Alfonso II, the king of other towns nearby, that he opens the casket once again, and once again there's an index, and Alfonso II really is the first person who clearly records that there is a sudarium present. And what happens next is that the casket gets closed again, and very much the casket has remained closed ever since. It was, as I said, only in recent years, the 1990s, that there was an interest in doing some scientific analysis on what was inside the casket. And today is one of those days when the sudarium is on public display. And what happens is that basically you enter the 4 o'clock mass, which is very long because it is Good Friday. You have the entire story of what happens on Good Friday, followed by a relatively brief mass service as such with Holy Communion. And then at the end of it, two people bring out the relic. It is held up in this case by the Archbishop who was presiding over the service today for about 5 minutes. Throughout certain texts are quoted, certain songs are sung. The bishop holds it to the congregation, and then at the end, basically wraps it up, almost literally. It is carried out of the church, and that is it. So you get to see on Good Friday the sudarium for about 5 minutes. One of the holiest relics, and the relic of all relics, apart from the true cross, which, you know, is in splinters across the world, really the only thing which has specifically to do with Christ and specifically to do with his body, so to speak, rather than other attributes which involve it. It is only done for 5 minutes. You have to know it is being brought out. There is no billboard saying "Come to Oviedo during Holy Week, and you will get to see a most unique relic." In fact, we found one little brochure which had one copy, and it was actually lying inside the cathedral, which actually said that if you attend this mass at the end, you will see the sudarium being brought out for a benediction. There's no big news, no big announcement that this is happening. And it's a big church, it's a big cathedral, and most of the people there are local. There were some tourists, there were some kind of, you know, people who were clearly positioning themselves, as were we, early on to get good viewing points as to where it would be seen. But we're talking here about maybe a dozen or so people. When you start comparing to the throng of people who were weaving themselves day in, day out to be in front of the Shroud of Turin last year, about 1 million people, if not more, came to the Shroud of Turin. Well, we're talking about 200-300 people today, and most of them would have come anyway because it is the mass in the cathedral on Good Friday, and the sudarium is almost like a little annex.
I want to be really clear about this. This is arguably the most well-documented and well-authenticated relic in Christendom, and potentially the most important outside of the Shroud of Turin, and nobody knows about it. And not only does nobody know about it, even if you do know about it and you come to Oviedo to see it, buena suerte, good luck. It's not easy. And they're really not terribly helpful. They're not unhelpful. They're very lovely people, actually, who run the cathedral. But they are not in any hurry to advertise that they have this relic. It is not posted anywhere. If you don't know it's there and go in very active search of it, you will not find it. And that to me is absolutely extraordinary. If you stumbled upon this and just happened to end up in the right part of the cathedral, which is not an easy task because you have to buy a ticket to go into the special room and you have to know it's there. If you just happened accidentally to do all of those things and happened to come upon the room that had a copy of it with the information that it was in there, you wouldn't believe it. You'd say, I can't possibly be reading this right, because if something this important to Christianity, something that potentially proves the crucifixion in the way that this does, existed, why doesn't anybody know about it? We stood there today and we were very fortunate with some things that happened today, and that we were actually personally able to be in the presence of it by ourselves, behind bars. I mean, we weren't able to touch it or anything, but we were in the same room with it alone for quite a good bit of time, probably on and off for about 20 to 30 minutes, which was amazing, given that in front of the Shroud of Turin, you're able to be in front of it for 3 minutes. But... you know, that is such a rare, rare thing. But there should be lines around the block. This is my point. You know, it's Good Friday. Pilgrims should be coming from all over the world to stand in front of this extraordinary relic. But nobody knows it exists.
And this is kind of like the conundrum I have, which is that so many people believe in Christianity, in Jesus, and in the gospel. But the hard evidence, the hardest evidence there is, two shrouds, when you overlap them, you find they match. They have the identical image. The blood type is identical. The Oviedo shroud proves that the carbon dating of the Turin shroud is inaccurate, because the Oviedo Shroud is known as a fact to be far older. It is 4 centuries older, so the carbon dating of the Turin Shroud cannot be factual. We know that the two shrouds combined, but specifically the Oviedo cloth, shows that the person on it was crucified. If this is a fake, somebody was crucified to do this. And then somehow, you know, you have to start doing the odds. Certain people love Occam's Razor. Well, Occam's Razor suggests the most logical solution is the one which is the most correct one. The most logical solution here is that this is indeed the crucifixion relic of Jesus Christ. And so you would expect that all of these believers come to see this. But it's hardly unknown. It's extraordinary that on a Good Friday, you have so few people in the Camera Santa, the place with all the relics. And in fact, it was somewhat interesting to see that after Mass, there was this enormous line of people who were all rushing into the Camera Santa before it was going to close, in the hope, I assume, that the relic was going to be brought back in there on time, which in my book might have made it a bit of a rush and unlikely to have happened. But all of a sudden, there is this interest of, like, you know, 50 people trying to get in there, and oh yes, we should try and see it after all before it disappears again for several months, because the only other time of the year when it is brought out is on the 14th of September and on the 21st of September. And this has to do with ceremonies involving the True Cross and other relics. And basically, it is a week where certain pardons are given. You are absolved from your sin. And that week in Oviedo is framed by twice bringing out the sudarium for veneration. So here we are. We're in northern Spain. We are in front of a relic which so few people know about. But it really, in my opinion, proves Christianity. And, you know, we have here a few books lying our table, but really, there is so little known about this relic, and it begs again the question, which is like the popes who this weekend are, prominent on every TV station across the world. Why are you not doing anything with these relics? Why are you hiding one here, largely? And why are you so skeptical about the Turin Shroud? You have good scientists here and scientists trying to get a word out about the Turin Shroud, saying this is all true. Science can prove pretty much the fact that this is a burial cloth of Jesus. Some can even go and say as far, well, there is no known mechanism as to how the image on the Turin Shroud comes about. But the church doesn't seem to be interested.
I think it's far more than the church not seeming to be interested. I think that the church has a vested interest in not displaying these relics. Again, this is something that we talk about in the show we did on the Turin Shroud, that there seems to be across the board a need almost to keep the faithful away from the relics that they know to be authentic, which I think is something that we really need to think about. Again, going back to the great book by Janice Bennett, there are phenomenal photographs in this book. This book is absolutely worth every penny you pay for it, for the photographs as well as the text. But the photographs are extraordinary because what they have done, and I want to emphasize that there is an organization who has been doing this study, and there have been a lot of scientists involved from all over the world in this study of the Oviedo Shroud. We actually picked up a book today that's 750 pages of reports that were done on the shroud. Ms. Bennett actually condenses all of this for you so you don't have to wade through every piece of the evidence. We are wont to do that because that's our job, but if you want a great summary of it, she certainly does that. But just to recap, the Shroud of Turin and the Oviedo Shroud are made of the same cloth, for example. The weave is similar, the cloth is the same, it's a certain type of linen. There is a certain kind of pollen that is found on both cloths that dates it to the 1st century and from Palestine. But the most extraordinary thing is the amount of work that has been done to check the bloodstains. This is high-tech CSI stuff, where they are, first of all, showing you recreations of how the shroud would have been wrapped around the victim's head. How the blood would have flowed, how they would. There are fingerprints on the Oviedo Shroud because it was traditional to block the nose so that the nose would stop bleeding after crucifixion, because apparently the nose could bleed profusely as a result of the crucifixion. So there's been this extraordinary, these recreations and everything that show you how the blood works. But for me, I mean, the smoking gun, the piece that just makes you gasp is when they overlay the blood stains of the Sudarium. Again, remember, Sudarium has been accounted for in Spain since about 616 AD. And when you overlay the Sudarium on top of the Shroud of Turin, the way that the blood stains match is nothing short of stunning. It really just makes you, it makes you gasp. It's really the first time I saw those photographs of how the blood stains match up, I was stunned. And all I could think of is how can anyone look at this and still believe that the shroud is a medieval fake? And the problem is nobody is looking at it. If they did look at it, they couldn't believe that. But I wanted to quote from an old French pilgrim song, something that I thought was really interesting. We learned this in Oviedo today, that French pilgrims used to sing about the Camino of Santiago de Compostela. They said, "Whoever goes to Santiago, to St. James's, and not to St. Saviour's in Oviedo, visits the servant and not the Lord." So we know going very far back into the early Middle Ages, when the pilgrims were going to Santiago, the French pilgrims were saying, Santiago is not the place where the real stuff is. The real deal is in Oviedo. And finally, I just want to say that I think that Janice Bennett makes a really interesting case in that she says, look, isn't it possible that because the church doesn't talk about this, because they keep it under wraps, because they don't promote it, isn't that precisely a case for it being authentic? Because people who criticize relics, we go through this with the atheist crowd all the time who say, oh, well, all these relics were invented so that people could make money in the Middle Ages and the church is still making money on them. Okay, fair enough, that did happen. But in cases like this, where you have this extraordinary relic that was really used for private veneration, and to this day in the 21st century is not advertised, is very much kept a secret, I think it does speak to the authenticity. I think that maybe that is the one thing that really lets us know that this is something that should not be ignored.
Absolutely. And well, we're going here from Good Friday to Easter, which is resurrection. And we need to resurrect another topic, which we devoted an entire show about 2 months ago. And we will get back to our other exploits in France. But first, we need to travel to Egypt, where there has been a remarkable resurrection and then crucifixion, because that is the way it seems to go in Egypt these days, off Zahi Hawass. Just to give you a brief overview of what happened before, obviously Dr. Zahi Hawass is the most notorious Egyptologist. To some people who watch National Geographic or the History Channel, they might even think he's the only Egyptologist because you only ever see him on television.
He wants it that way.
And fortunately or unfortunately, from whatever perspective you want to approach this, there are actually more Egyptologists than Dr. Hawass. And so what happened on January 25th was obviously the Egyptian Revolution began. And when Mubarak stepped down, there was a change of regime, a new prime minister. And just before, Zahi Hawass had been made Minister of Antiquities, a new position within the regime of Mubarak, which, when the new prime minister was elected or voted, became something of a controversy. At first, the Minister of Antiquities was stopped, and it was decided that the Supreme Council of Antiquities would be reinstated and would once again report back into the Ministry of Culture. However, within a matter of hours or a day, it was decided that there was really a need for a Minister of Antiquities, and so that the position would become open again. Now, when all of this was happening, there was a strong voice that Hawass would not be the Minister of Antiquities for two reasons. One, that the new Prime Minister was not going to look benignly upon Hawass and his alliance with Mubarak, because to all intents and purposes, Hawass is a man of the old regime. He has been extremely strongly linked with specifically Suzanne Mubarak, the wife of the president, or the former president now. And so what we had was a very volatile situation, and Hawass said that he was refusing to take up a position in the new government because basically everything the new government stood for was not what he wanted, and specifically that the new government was in no position whatsoever to guarantee that the relics of ancient Egypt, this time rather than of Christianity, would remain sacred and safe. So that was the situation. Hawass had stepped down, Hawass had cleared off his desk, and there was active discussion as to who would replace him. A name was put forward, actually a person I know myself, and then that name was withdrawn. And then out of the blue, amidst widespread information that Hawass was going to stand trial for disobeying something, he was elected or appointed Interim Minister of Antiquities for 6 months, basically up until the next elections. And we thought that Egypt was once again sliding into its own problems, and this wasn't just visible with Hawass as such alone, but also with things around him. The people once again were taking to the streets. They were saying that the military were doing stuff, but not as good as it should be. That one regime had been exchanged for exactly the same regime, and that in some cases there was a new face to it, but in the case of Hawass, the old face was back. And then something extraordinary happened a week ago, which is that a court case which was supposed to have been happening, I think on March 13th, finally occurred, and the judge basically sentenced Hawass to 1 year in jail, roughly $1,500 worth, and also the order that he should step down as Minister of Antiquities. And what has happened is something very simple, but it also shows the absolute arrogance of this man, which has to do with the museum. The Egyptian Museum in Cairo has a bookshop, and the bookshop was located near the main entrance. It was run by a family. And then Hawass decided that he was going to change the position of the main entrance for various reasons, which always seem logical, but are always, in Hawass logic, and that therefore also was a need for a new bookshop, which you then find out he is one of the shareholders in. And so the family who was running the old bookshop basically said that it was unfair that they were excluded from running and putting in a tender for the new bookshop. What happened was a court case. The judge ordered that that there was a tender. The tender was run so abysmally bad, and guess what? Came in favor of the shop, and the owners of Hawass, rather than the family who had been running it for several years, if not decades. And the family once again took it to the judge. The judge, to cut a long story short, the judge basically said to Hawass, "You have to stop what you're doing. This family have won and need to run the new bookshop. You're not obeying my judgment. You need to do this." And Hawass simply neglected a court order. So what happened next was that the family continued, and what happened a week ago is that Hawass was convicted to 1 year in jail, basically because he failed to obey a court order. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the face of Egyptology. This is a person, and really I am appalled the way academics remain silent about this, because this is the joke of academics now. This is a man who disobeys the law, basically is caught up in scandal after scandal. This is the third scandal he's been involved with. He's been removed twice from his position, once as head of the Giza Plateau, once in his role of SEA. He had a person reporting into him who was put in jail, basically saying a person who reported directly into him. He got away with saying, "Oh, I didn't know anything what this person was doing. All the money was he was withholding." There are allegations that over $1 billion in artifacts have been smuggled out with the active participation of Hawass. There is an extraordinary inquiry happening at this moment in time, trying to find out whether or not this is indeed the case. But at this moment in time, with Mubarak gone, basically the judicial operations are so swamped with new allegations, and this, even though it is $1.5 billion, fails in comparison with the $70 billion they're trying to recover from the Mubaraks and various other ministers at higher positions than Hawass. But this is the joke. This is showing you how academics and how all of this little group of people control Egypt, but are so dirty that really some people should step up. And academics are so quick to point out the evils of people they believe are not doing correct academic research. And my mind always goes to poor Samos Magic at the Bosnian Pyramids, who is the butt of so many academic reproaches. But where are the academics now saying Mr. Hawash should step down? Because basically, every single second that Hawass is in power really is a joke on the academics. It is simply a joke.
I suppose Dr. Hawass will not be chasing mummies anymore now, will he?
Well, he should chase them, and he should really run away from them as fast as he can, because the mummies are not in good hands.
But do you think, I mean, look, we have seen him land on his feet again and again and again. And every time we think we have seen the end of Zahi Hawass, he resurrects himself. Do we think this is finally it? Do we think he has finally met his match? Do we think we are finally going to see Zahi Hawass move off of the international stage in terms of controlling and oppressing Egyptian antiquities for the future?
Well, I hope so, and I think to some extent I was flabbergasted when he was appointed Ministry of Antiquities. There was a campaign to discredit the new person who was going to take over from him, which was clearly something which had been going on for some weeks. And even though there were some other candidates who could take over from him, for some reason it never matured. But really, the period of time where he was kind of like out and then back in was the period of this court case. This court case was known to people to happen. It was imminent. It was going to happen. And so the thought came to my mind, which is this: Egyptology is controlled by American universities. They put in millions of dollars to basically get the best gigs in town. The bond between Hawass and these American universities is extremely tight, extremely strong, and very powerful. And it rides on the back of American diplomacy and American government, which is inches away from what is happening on an Egyptological level. It is known, quite well known, that American universities in the past have been abused by such things as the CIA to put certain people in Egypt at a time when you want to have people there. So all of these things are recorded. This isn't just science, this is politics and science all merged into ones. And on one side you have the nebulous American government and American universities, and on the other side you have one man, Hawass. And even though in Egypt you might try to get rid of Hawass, you realize that it's a very complex situation. And so the thought I had is whether the new government realized this extraordinary complexity and decided to appoint Hawass, knowing that actually, his appointment would also signal his demise. That really now they are making it an example. They are basically saying, Hawass, we're going to put you out there, and when you're out there, and when you think you're safe, we're going to execute you. And to some extent, people will say, well, he hasn't been executed because he's appealed. He's saying that this is all wrong, that he's done nothing wrong. Once again, he's a victim of circumstances, as he always pretends he is. But the fact of the matter is that he is appealing, and if his appeal is not heard, or the appeal is heard and it's not proven to be valid, Mr. Hawass is going to jail for 1 year.
We'll see. I'll believe it when it happens. But I think that I do think that there is a morality play at work here, and I think that there are an awful lot of people who would have been instrumental in orchestrating his demise, because it really goes back to the old tried and true adage: be very careful who you step on your way up, because they will be more than happy to help you come down.
Absolutely. And to some extent, there is progress. I mean, when we start looking in 2003, when there were allegations of the $1.5 billion, this isn't just some wild allegation. Despite the incredible amount of money involved, 1,600 documents have been submitted and were submitted at the time, showing the nature of all of these things. And What happened then was simply, you know, that the judicial system was told not to devote any attention to this, and this is an open case. Nobody looked at it for 8 years because it was a way of making sure that nothing happened. And the progress here is that people have been looking at these things. Justice has been spoken, and justice is the last resort for Hawass to try and find out whether he can swing himself out of there. So whether he stays in power for a bit longer or not, this idea that he is a right man, that he is a good man, has been completely shattered. And even if he stays as Minister of Antiquities for another 10 years, it is now clear and a matter of judicial records that he is a crook.
Well, we'll keep you posted as this develops because clearly Philip is entirely obsessed with this subject and has been watching it very, very closely because it's been an important part of your life. It's been an important part of the lives of a lot of the people that we have worked with and care about because Hawass has been so instrumental in controlling everything that happens in Egypt. And I'm just going to say the same thing that I say every time the subject comes up, which is A, karma, and B, more than anything, I just hope that whoever ends up in that position is willing to open their minds and open the boundaries a little bit of Egyptology and allow some of these extraordinary alternative researchers to really get in there and look at some of these discoveries that they've been making that Hawass has been squashing for such a long time.
Absolutely, and just like the Pope is kind of, you know, pushing so many relics into behind bars, the distance between so many relics of Christianity, and the truth of Christianity not coming out with these shrouds, the same thing is happening. The oppressor of the truth of Egypt is Hawass. But there are also stories which we came across in this week while driving through France, stories which really are there for the explanation. And even though I had been there many, many, many moons ago, in fact about 13 years ago, probably one of the highlights of our trip was a vi visit to the most extraordinary megalithic monument in existence, anywhere on this planet at this moment in time, the enormous megalithic alignments, stone circles, and the largest stone ever erected, unfortunately since collapsed, in and around Karnak.
Karnak is extraordinary, and an interesting sort of turn of events. The day that we were visiting Karnak, we discovered later on that they were also the History Channel was also airing an episode of Ancient Aliens, the show that Philip is on, about Karnak on the same night. So I thought that was sort of fun. Wow, Karnak, again. You know, this is one of those extraordinary things. Karnak is such a wonder of the world. It is one of those things that you look upon and you sort of can't believe your eyes. But, you know, more than anything, as you wander through those stones, and there are literally kilometers of them in extraordinary formations and lined up, and they're placed in such a specific and intentional way. And you can sense them and you can feel them. And as you walk through those stones, you can feel your body and your spirit and your psyche and everything changing. You know that there's something magical going on here. And we know that these stones have been there for anywhere from 4 to 7,000 years. 6,000 is sort of the rough estimate. Most believe that they've been there since about 4,000 BC. But my question again, as I walk through these stones, is, why doesn't anybody talk about Karnak? Why doesn't Karnak get more press? Stonehenge gets so much attention, and look, Stonehenge is fabulous. It is magnificent, but Karnak is gigantic. It's kilometers worth of stones. Why is it that nobody talks about Karnak?
And I think to some extent that might be the problem. It bedazzles the mind. It's not something which you can show and say, kind of like, look, you know, there's a stone circle. Which, you know, Stonehenge is so easy visitable. It's there and you've done in almost 3 minutes. Avebury, which is nearby Stonehenge, that is also visitable, but already gets less attention. And megaliths are everywhere, and they get so little attention. And one of the greatest things which I began to do, and which I will continue to do, and definitely more so in the near and long-term future, is to really get more information out there about these megaliths, because the megaliths are everywhere. Every country in Europe has them. To some extent, countries even in the New World has some of them, specifically around the area of, say, East America. You have them everywhere and so prominently in France. But when it comes to Carnac, there are gigantic stones weighing tons upon tons upon tons everywhere. And the joke is kind of almost like, okay, we've put 500 of them in an alignment. Let's do some more. Let's go for 700. Oh, and when we're done here, let's do some more even further down. So it's stone upon stone placed in these alignments, and then you have the traditional dolmen, the traditional standing stones, and including one standing stone which at one point was projecting 20 meters, 20 yards into the sky, and then it collapsed at some point, in the last 6,000 years, and broke into pieces. But just an extraordinary amount of stone, and you don't know where to look first. And I think the problem is that you don't know where to begin. They are mute witnesses in the sense that because there are so many of them, they define a purpose. A stone circle like Stonehenge is relatively simple to explain. But even then, you run into trouble. You know that there are certain alignments to the sun and to the moon and maybe to some stars. And that's kind of like where scientists and archaeologists are happy about. Oh, yes, we've explained it now. People like John North, who've looked into Stonehenge a bit more deeply, realize that that is simply not the case. All of this was clearly religious in nature. This wasn't just some astronomical observatory. This was to do with religion, with something else. And whereas to some extent with Stonehenge you can get somewhere, but not too many archaeologists are actually going there. When it comes to Karnak, you don't know where to look first, and so basically they leave it untouched.
We had some really extraordinary experiences at Karnak, and we will be sharing those with you in some more depth. They will certainly have their own show at one point, and we're writing some things. But it was such an extraordinary experience, and it is leading to, I think, such an interesting theory on why those stones were put there. And what they may actually mean, that I don't think we're quite ready to reveal that yet, because I think it really deserves some in-depth work that we are still we're still it's still percolating. It's just happened. This is all really, really fresh. This is just happening over the last couple of days. But Brittany has been extraordinary for us. First of all, for me, it's just this magical combination of everything I love about the Celtic countries, placed in the middle of France. I mean, it's heaven for me. It's this, a beautiful combination. There were many times when we were driving through Brittany when, if you had just placed me there and told me to open my eyes, I would have told you I was in Ireland. The landscape felt very Irish to me, looked Irish, felt Irish. There's an awful lot of Ireland in Brittany. Of course, Brittany is one of the Celtic nations. But I don't think that I was expecting it to feel quite as Irish as it did. So for me, being part Irish and part French and part Scottish, Brittany just kind of feels like home because it really is the combination of all of my heritage in one place. But one of the great surprises for me in Brittany was that, it just seemed like around every corner was another church called Notre Dame de something. And as you may or may not know, the majority of churches that are called Notre Dame originally had Black Madonnas in them. And we are always on the trail of the Black Madonna when we are in France. We're always looking for Black Madonnas. And I have actually been told in the past that there are no Black Madonnas in Brittany. And even, all of the big Black Madonna books and researchers, they only recognize one. There is one Black Madonna in Gwyngamp, and she is phenomenal. She is magnificent. We've just photographed her. We're going to get her up on, she'll be on my website, kathleenmcgowan.com. She is life-sized. I've never seen anything quite like her. She's magnificent. But she is not the only Black Madonna in Brittany. There are a number of Black Madonnas, and they are extraordinary. The very first one we found actually was not the Gwynedd Madonna. It was, in fact, in
Pontivy.
Pontivy, the beautiful, extraordinary town of Pontivy, called to us, and we went to visit the cathedral there. And upon entering the cathedral and turning left, as we walked in, we were greeted with this gigantic and beautiful portrait of Mary Magdalene. And Pontivy unveiled its secrets to us as we continued to walk through it and came upon an extraordinary Black Madonna. So we'll be telling the stories of these Breton Black Madonnas that we have discovered, and I look very much forward to coming back to Brittany very soon and continuing the exploration of the world of the Black Madonna in Brittany, because again, this is very much the theme of this show, is discovering extraordinary things that are hidden in plain sight, but nobody talks about.
But that we also came across something which was there in plain sight, and people have spoken about it. And we kind of like, well, not wanting to end the show on a downer, but along these lines, we jump in cars and drive around in our efforts to find out and get answers. And one of the things which we have been extraordinarily interested in finding and delving into was the Cross of Hendaye. And there is a small village, town maybe, at the edge of France and Spain. It really is a border town. And in the cemetery, up until some time ago, and now just outside of the Church of Saint Vincente, Saint Vincent, is a cross. It's a relatively normal cross, with an inscription and four images on its base. It's not that big, but an awful lot has been written about it. And it was a French alchemist who used a pseudonym called Fulcanelli who wrote about it and basically said that the Cross of Hendaye was the most extraordinary thing ever. It was a testament to alchemy. It was going to reveal information about the end of times, the apocalypse. It had alchemical secrets. And documentaries have been made about it. A book has been written about it. Really, there's an awful lot of hype with extremely little content. And when you start analyzing certain things, and when you start putting certain things on this on within context, when you start looking at the inscriptions rather than the drawings from the inscriptions, when you start kind of like going beyond it, you really find that what has been made of this cross isn't really living up to the reality of this cross. And I think what we are confronted with here is something which is very, which I come across a lot, which is specifically to do with French mysteries, which is that the French go about their mysteries in a different way. French, specifically a few decades ago, needed gimmicks. The French realized that they sometimes held tremendous truths, but really had a hard time getting them out. And the Cross of Hendaye seems to be one of these gimmicks which Fulcanelli used to impart certain alchemical information, the kind of like the basics of alchemy, if you want. And it just seems that the American, the Anglo-Saxon mindset, as it is called in France, simply went, as it's unfortunately so often the case, on a very literal interpretation, a very detailed analysis, almost using numbers and degrees and percentages of degrees into trying to explain something which really shouldn't be explained in such a way. And the Cross of Hendaye kind of like has become an unfortunate victim of that.
Well, for me, the Cross of Hendaye was such a letdown, because it's something that I've really been looking forward to examining for a really long time. And I read the difficult to read, but I did read The Cross at the End of Time, the book that was written about it, which is an analysis of the Fulcanelli material. And these particular authors have gone on to analyze that they believe that this cross pointed to an apocalypse, which actually was already supposed to happen and didn't happen. And I've always found it fascinating based on the information I had about it, but when we went to see it, it was such a letdown. But it was also a very important lesson. Let me tell you what that lesson is. And I have said this over and over again, and this gets me in trouble every time I say it, but you know what? The truth against the world, I have to say it. Academics who sit in their libraries, and other researchers who sit in their libraries and do not spend enough time out in the field do not make accurate conclusions. Period. If you do not spend an awful lot of time in the field on this work, you cannot make an accurate conclusion. And here is an example. The Cross of Hendaye has upon its base a series of letters. They are capital A's. There are four of them in a cross shape. They're kind of interesting. They have an interesting crossbar. The crossbar ends in a little bit of a triangle. They're kind of an unusual letter, and I have the books that are written about Hendaye go on and on and on about how because this letter A has a strange crossbar, it must be a secret, it must be a code, it must have a hidden meaning. And we have pages upon pages of medieval watermarks and who used these A's. And it goes on and on and on about all the reason why this A represents some alchemical thing. But when you're standing in the middle of Hendaye, which is a Basque town, and looking at these A's on the cross, all you have to do is look up at any street sign, anything written in Basque, anywhere in Hendaye or in Basque country, to discover that there is nothing at all strange about these A's. It's a very traditional piece of Basque writing. The A in Basque is written this way. In fact, the A is written this way throughout northern Spain. It's written this way in Asturias. We see this A everywhere. So if you happen to be an American who doesn't have a lot of experience with this part of the world, you might look at this and say, "Oh gosh, look, it's alchemical. It looks like a mason symbol because it's an angle." You can go on and on and on. You can make anything into whatever you want, but really, in essence, you're strictly looking at something that is a representation of a Basque alphabet. And I'm so sorry to break this to all of you who might think that the Cross of Hendaye means something alchemical, is something about the apocalypse. And even those of you who think that Folcanelli is the greatest alchemist of our time, because I actually happen to think he might have been the biggest trickster of our time. I am here to tell you that my analysis of the Cross of Hendaye, after spending some time with it, and I'm going to do a little bit more work with this because I need to work on the Basque symbolism and I'm going to write about it. I think the cross at Hendaye was a funerary monument for an important Basque separatist leader, and it is, in fact, a monument to the fact that the Basque people will one day have some kind of freedom and independence. And I don't believe that it is anything more or less than that.
And that really is nothing more or less than the end of our show. We have traveled from Turin Shroud to Oviedo Shroud to Karnak Megaliths via Egypt and onto the Cross of Hendaye. And we continue traveling, and we will be reporting on our next show about our next traveling week. But until then, from the two of us,
the truth against the world.